I said before, we're very excited to see all of you with us. This event came about fairly recently, and we're so glad that it did. We're so glad that our two speakers agreed to do this event together. We have known, well, first let me formally introduce them. Our two speakers are Swami Padmanabha and Dr. Jeffrey Long. Swami Padmananda says that he, at an early age, delved deeply into the theology of diverse mystical traditions, and after taking up Gaudiya Vaishnavism, I'm sorry if I butchered that, you can correct me, please. In 1999, at the age of 19, he's dedicated himself to the extensive study of the Gaudiya scriptures under the guidance of various mentors. And he's fluent in English and Spanish, and has written hundreds of articles in both languages, with his first two books published in English and in the process of being translated now to other languages. And for the past 20 years, he's traveled around the world and lectured in universities, ashrams, and yoga studios. And all of his various talks are available, and seminars are available online for free at his website. And I'll put, I'm going to copy that link address and put that in the chat. So you might, if you want, if you like what you heard this evening and you want to hear more, you can go to his website. And he's a leader of spiritual retreats and communities, and inspires both practitioners and visitors with his penetrating teachings and personal example. Dr. Jeffrey Long is a professor of religion, philosophy, and Asian studies for Elizabethtown College, and specializes in the religions and philosophies of India. He's the author of several books and numerous articles, and editor of a series called Explorations in Indic Traditions for Lexington Books. In 2022, his book Hinduism in America, A Convergence of Worlds, received the Rajinder and Jyoti Gandhi Award for Excellence in Theology, Philosophy, and Critical Engagement. And he has spoken in numerous venues, both national and international, including three talks at the United Nations. And he's been interviewed for a PBS documentary on the life and teachings of Swami Vivekananda, and for the History Channel series Holy Marvels. And I'm sure, as he will probably tell you, he is a practitioner of Hinduism, not just a scholar of Hinduism, and he can tell you his specific tradition. So with that, I guess what we have several topics that we could be in conversation about. And so the first one that I'll throw out there to both Dr. Long and Swami Padmanabha, are what are their perspectives on the dynamic nature of God and reality from your two traditions? And if you want to say again more about your tradition, you can do that as well.
Jeffrey, you would like to begin, please?
Oh, I would like to defer to you, and in keeping with our tradition,
I'd like to honor the elders first, so you are my elder
well,
first.
that's very kind of you. Well, thank you very much, and I will happily accept that. First, I want to thank Sherry and everyone for organizing this. This is wonderful. Some of you, I think, might know that I've been writing for some time on Hinduism and process thought, and developing process thought from Hindu perspective. And I've been more or less alone in this for some time. And it was just wonderful a few months ago that I got to very blessed to make the acquaintance of Swami Padmanabhaji, and find that his interest in this is very, very strong and very profound. And coming from his experience and perspective in the Vaishnava tradition of Hinduism. And so he'll say, of course, more about that. I can speak about the dynamic nature of God, dynamic nature of reality from the point of view of my particular tradition. For those of you who are not so familiar with Hinduism, I'll just give the really super quick, 101 version. Just like Christianity, just like Islam, just like Buddhism, there are many different traditions that make up what we call by this collective term Hindu or Hinduism or Sanatana Dharma. And that we call these sampradayas. And denomination may be an okay translation of that, sub traditions. And my particular tradition is a relatively new one. It was introduced to the United States by Swami Vivekananda back in the 1890s. And he was presenting the teaching of his guru, his master, Sri Ramakrishna, who lived in the earlier in the 19th century. And Sri Ramakrishna, one of the things that's distinctive and interesting about him, though you actually see quite a bit of this as you study the history of India, he was not exclusive in his outlook when it came to traditions. He didn't identify exclusively with any one sampradaya within the Hindu tradition, nor even exclusively with Hinduism. He had a period when he practiced Islam, he had a period when he practiced Christian devotion, and it was his view that all paths lead to the realization, the experience of ultimate reality. And this is really very central to his teaching. And it was one of the things that appealed to me from an early age about this particular tradition. I'm very much about this idea of pluralism, right? That we can find truth everywhere. And so when it comes to the idea of the dynamic nature of God, one of the things that's interesting that we find in Hindu traditions is there's kind of a spectrum, you could say, in terms of whether traditions emphasize the eternality and changelessness of the divine. On one hand, we could call that one pole. And then on the other pole, there is dynamism and a much more of a what we might think of as a process orientation toward divinity. And Sri Ramakrishna taught that these were both valid. There are many, many centuries of scholastic debate among adherents of these schools of thought over which one was correct, which one best represents divinity as we find it in the Vedic scriptures, which we all share. And so from the perspective of the tradition of Sri Ramakrishna, there is the dynamic nature of God. This is what we experience in the realm of time, space, and causation. We experience divine grace. We experience divinity as a presence. These are all things that are very much attested in our scriptures and in the life of Ramakrishna and the life of other great beings. And so this is very much in keeping with the dynamic concept of divinity that we find in process thought. At the same time, there's the idea that there is this eternal and unchanging nature of the divine. We find this also in process thought. If you read Charles Hartshorne, he talks about the absolute pole or the eternal pole of God's existence and the relative pole. He could be talking from within the Ramakrishna tradition because we also use this term of the relative and the absolute. And one of the things we strongly affirm is the reality of both. You'll find a tendency sometimes in the non-dualistic tradition, the Advaita Vedanta tradition, which we also identify with, but you'll find very often a tendency to regard the dynamic nature of God as somehow not quite fully real, right? As not, the true nature is the changeless nature. But Sri Ramakrishna departed from this. He said, you can realize God, you can experience the divine reality, you can draw close to and feel that divine reality as a living presence through the relative changing aspect, or you can become absorbed in that unchanging nature. And these are both real and both important. And I guess the last thing I'll say about this is if we think pluralistically, you could say that most of the major world religions orient around one or the other of these poles, right? We have theistic religion, which is oriented around the supreme being, who is a being of pure love, who interacts with the world. And then you have traditions that organize around the idea of an impersonal ultimate principle that's kind of behind the scenes of changing reality. So you have traditions like Buddhism, Taoism, and so on. And yeah, from the perspective of the Ramakrishna tradition, these are just all varied ways of approaching that which is infinite and finally beyond anything we can even conceive.
Beautiful. Thank you. Thank you, Jeff. Swami, would you like to jump in now?
Yeah, thank you so much. Thank you, Jeff, for your words, and thank you, Sherry, and all the people from the process community for the invitation. It's my honor and it's my joy and surprise. It was, as Jeff said, it unfolded very quickly, to my surprise. Very spontaneously, we gather all together here today, and so I'm very happy to see you all. So, in connection to my particular tradition, Gaudiya Vaishnavism, this is a tradition also relatively new, if we consider the tradition starting from its founder being Sri Chaitanya, which in our tradition is considered a manifestation of the divine, appearing on earth in 1486. So this is a monotheistic tradition called Vaishnav, as Jeffrey very nicely said. Hinduism is an umbrella term that encompasses so many possibilities. And its main monotheistic expression is called Vaishnavism. And inside Vaishnavism, we have Gaudiya Vaishnavism and one of those particular expressions of it, which almost like 700 million followers throughout the world. So technically speaking, it's the third largest monotheistic world religion in one sense. I try sometimes to make that case because many times that's not very much taken. So Gaudiya Vaishnavism is a very, as Jeffrey also say, we are based on the same scriptures, if you will, on the Vedas and Upanishads and Bhagavad Gita and Vedanta and so on. And interestingly, the idea of God being changeless and God being ever-evolving, dynamic, is present there. Our particular philosophical, metaphysical system is called Achintya Bheda Abheda. And Bheda Abheda means, in one sense, different and non-different. And it's a way of saying changeless and ever and dynamic. No? And for us, both of them exist, coexist in harmony, paradoxically in harmony. So, for example, there is this interesting term to address God, probably the main name to address the absolute in the Upanishads, which is Brahman. And Brahman many times is related to a changeless, impersonal, if you will, face of the absolute. But interestingly, if we go to the very meaning of the word Brahman, the Sanskrit root, the dhatu, is brim. And the word brim means to grow and to expand. So that's a very interesting thing. Now, the main word for God in Hinduism, the very meaning of the word implies growth and expansion. So in one sense, it's talking from the very onset about ever-evolvingness, so to say, right? And I'm very passionate about this topic, especially because I'm just about to finish my third book on this topic. So sorry if I get too passionate talking about that. It's just, I'm just finishing it. So I'm in those waters now. So Brahman, paradoxically, while related to a changeless aspect of the divine, its intrinsic meaning and purpose of the word has to do with growth and expansion. In our particular tradition, one of the main names that we will attach to God is Krishna. You may have heard Krishna means all attractive. So it's a form to address the divine in terms of beauty. And in different sections of our scriptures, that beauty is said to be in constant growth and expansion. And we will present this interplay between love and God's beauty. In other words, I won't quote the Sanskrit now, not to torture the audience, but one of our main verses say, the more the devotee, the bhakta in bhakti in the tradition of love, the more love a devotee expresses, the more beautiful God becomes. Now, like the more love, the more beauty. And the more beauty God has, the more love is inspired in the heart of the devotee. And both of them enter into a competition of increasing their love and his beauty, God becoming more beauty, the worshiper becoming more loving. The two of them enter into a competition when neither two of them accept defeat, so to say. No? Like implying the idea of ongoing, perpetual unfolding and expansion of beauty and love and so on. So when we talk about God being changeless in our particular tradition, we'll say, of course, God is changeless in the fact that, in the sense that he always is God. He has always been God. He always remains God. He will never stop being God. That doesn't change. Or we could say he's changeless in the sense that he's always evolving, and that doesn't change about him. So we can make also that idea. His changelessness has to do with his ever-evolvingness. So there are different ways in which we explain this particular idea, but it's quite connected to the idea of God and love being ever-evolving. Now, for us, first comes love, so to say, and then we start to talk about God, so to say. First, love as ever-evolving is the source of reality. In our tradition, God is described as a servant of love. No? There is a very poetic description which mentions him as a student in the school of love. So the nature of love is ever-evolving. We will say love has no true opposite, So love can never become less of what it is, but it can only become more of what it is. It can only grow in its own very nature. So by that very nature, love that is always expanding, it's constantly impacting and affecting God, basically. You know? So we will describe God as in love, or non-different from love, of course. Like the Bible, like Christianity will say God is love, we'll say the same thing. Raso vai saha, the absolute is love personified. So a few thoughts in that connection from our particular Gaudiya tradition.
Beautiful. Thank you. Thank you. I want to now go to the topic of human purpose, consciousness, and radical personalism. So maybe should we go back to Jeffrey for his comments here?
Sure. Though Swamiji is the expert on radical personalism, he has a book of that title. So I look forward to what he has to say about it. But I could say a few preliminary things, which would be that in terms of, you know, when we think of human consciousness, one of the things that I think is important to understand in the Hindu traditions is that on the one hand, it's non-anthropocentric, right? That all living beings are what we call jivas. Jiva basically means a living being, a, you know, life force. It's often translated as soul, because living being doesn't mean only the body. The body is the current expression, the current existence of that jiva. But as most of you probably know, in the Hindu tradition, we have this idea of rebirth. So the jiva comes back again and again to fulfill its ultimate purpose of uniting with divinity. And so what we experience as evolving consciousness is the emergence of a potential that's already present within us. And in Swami Vivekananda's writings, he coins a word, it might have been used before him, but he's the first that I'm aware of using it. It's a sort of parallel to evolution he calls involution. Right? You have the idea that if we look at, for example, the history of life on Earth, from a scientific perspective, we talk about consciousness evolving, right, from simpler forms to more complex forms. And then finally, you get human beings, and there may be something even more complex later on. But that can also be seen as spirit involving itself into our material world, right, manifesting in and as conscious beings. And so this divine process can be seen from either of those perspectives. And I want to bring in another Hindu thinker here who is not sort of generally identified with my particular tradition, but I think he should be because he's very much in continuity with it, which is Sri Aurobindo. And in fact, with Sri Aurobindo, you can connect him to Teilhard de Chardin in a kind of process Catholic tradition, and with Whitehead to some extent, because it's a very similar trajectory of thought. And it's Aurobindo who really takes this concept of involution and unpacks it fully, so that divinity, that there is God, right? But there is also that in us that is of a divine essence, you could say, that the jiva in its essence has divine qualities, right? It has the potential of infinite bliss, infinite awareness, and so on. And so what we are doing life after life is gradually unfolding and manifesting that, right? And this is all for the greater divine glory. And as we would say in process thought, in the Whiteheadian tradition, that as we develop these ever richer modes of consciousness and modes of experience, God is also experiencing that through us. And one of my favorite quotations, it's actually from someone who's quite a skeptic about religion and spirituality, but the late great Dr. Carl Sagan has this wonderful quote, and I've actually put it in my part of my email signature. I like it so much. He says, "We are a way for the cosmos to know itself." Right? That there's this tendency that human beings have to think about, you know, ourselves as human beings and the world as something else, something separate. But we are part of this whole cosmic organism. So our consciousness is, you could say, a spark, or if we want to use the water image, a drop of that larger ocean of consciousness as it's manifesting. So we are the manifestation of that in the world. And what we are here to do is to manifest that in ever richer, ever more beautiful, ever more powerful ways in the world around us. And very much in keeping with what Swamiji said just previously, this enriches God as well, right? When we're talking about the God who is ever evolving, the God who's transforming, that evolution is happening partially through us, and we are part of it. We are part of that evolution, an extension of that evolution.
Beautiful. Swami.
Beautiful. Thank you, Jeffrey. And of course, I could have said all those things myself, not as eloquently as you, but those are totally aligned with my own tradition. So I won't repeat myself, but thank you so much for those words, Jeffrey. And I really appreciate it when you mentioned about talking about the jiva or the living force as the potential of the jiva. So in our tradition, the soul, if you want to call it like that, so the jiva, the living entity, is potency or shakti in Sanskrit, and every potency has potential. So we are potency plus potential. Einstein is said to say something like that. You can never analyze something without considering its potential, all that it can be in becoming. So, of course, it's not up to us only. Matter is also potency plus potential. And I appreciate what Jeffrey mentioned in terms of the interconnectedness of everything and how we can, if something is evolving somehow that has a repercussion in the environment, we in our tradition have this term sambandha, which basically refers to the conceptual orientation that guides our practice, the theory to engage us in practice and then attain a particular result. So sambandha, interestingly, means sambandha. Everything, sambandha, is tied or connected. So our education in the Gaudiya tradition is to learn how everything is connected or interconnected. So when we are talking about evolution or love evolving, God's evolving, how that is having a repercussion in so many other directions as well, in terms of potential as well. So that say, going to the jiva or to the atma or to the soul, something interestingly that comes to my mind on human purpose and human consciousness is what comes to mind is the first aphorism of Vedanta, Vedanta Sutra, one of our main texts. And the very first aphorism or sutra says, Atato Brahma Jignasa, which means now it's time to inquire into Brahman. So now there are many interpretations, but one of the interpretations is now that you have human consciousness by which you can read this book and understand what does it say. So Atato now, Brahma Jignasa, you can inquire into Brahman. So now that you are a human, your duty, your dharma, is to inquire into Brahman. And as we say, Brahman means that which expands and makes others to expand. That's basically the definition of Brahman. So if the duty of human consciousness is to inquire into that which is ever expansive, naturally our own duty or our own pursuit of that reality is ever expansive and ever evolving as well. So that's an important point that in our tradition it is being mentioned. Like human consciousness has a lot to do with potential, with all that we can be, and there is no limit to that. There is no limit to all that love can be, all that God can be. And in that connection, just to close my words, a few words on radical personalism, and I'm sure that it was Jeffrey the ones who suggested that topic, so thank you so much for inviting me to talk about that. It's a favorite topic of mine. That's it. Title of my second book. And radical personalism is, for me, another way of referring to my own tradition, Gaudiya Vaishnavism, which means at the root of reality. Radical comes from the Latin radix, which means root. So at the very root of reality, according to our cosmovision, everything is a person, ultimately. Everything has a quality of personhood attached to it. Everything is relationship. Basically, everything in its ultimate expression is possessed of relationality. So from that particular perspective, we will see in our tradition different sages addressing so-called inert phenomena of this world in personalized terms. No, the mountains, the rivers, everything has a name. Or ultimately, we will say, if you don't want to accept that, in our philosophy, we'll say, in every single atom, God is residing in his omnipresence. So there is a person in every atom, ultimately, in the form of the divine, all-pervading presence there. So for us, for me, and for those who agree with this particular approach of radical personalism, the idea is to integrate all that is our sense of self, our persona, even on a psychic and emotional level in the bhakti tradition that I belong. We can invoke the presence of the divine and we can spiritualize our physical situation, our mental, emotional situation. All of that can be spiritualized and even accompany us in transcendence, basically. And one last point that we emphasize in terms of radical personalism is we want God to be a person and we want to relate with that person through the most personal of all dealings, which is love. So we are supposed to allow God to be as a person as he would like to be. So that's why in our tradition, we address the divine with the title, the supreme personality of Godhead. Not like God in his most person, allowing God to be as a person as he can be. And of course, that in turn would invite us to be as personal as we can be. So a few words on radical personalism in that connection, yeah.
Wonderful. Thank you. I want to go now to the, and this is maybe too many topics to have as one question, but the ideas of astonishment, surrender, divine will and human choice, and grace.
Okay.
So you can pick one of those. Yeah. Or
I'm astonished now. I don't know where to begin.
Well, I have to say that this is also an area where when I speak about it, I kind of step a little bit out of the scholar mode and into more of the practitioner mode. And I really, really love something that Swamiji just said, which is, you know, letting God be God, right? That when we come to spiritual practice, when we whatever form it takes, prayer, meditation, we bring our ideas of divinity to that. And to some extent, that's necessary. We're in this realm of space, time, and causation. So, you know, we need to orient in some particular way. One way we do this in the Hindu tradition is through concrete forms, right? Through what we call murtis, the images of various forms of Godhead and so on. But it can also be constraining. I think this is really the insight at the heart of those traditions that don't use any kind of imagery, right? The idea that the divine is infinite and therefore can't be confined, not just in a physical form, but in an idea, right? And that if we approach divinity, I think with a too rigid or dogmatic concept of what the divine is, we cut ourselves off from being able to experience something of what the divine reality is actually trying to show us. And so I feel moved to share something actually quite personal that I shared with Swamiji a few weeks ago, or maybe it's a few months ago now. Time flies. And I haven't really discussed with anyone else, but I shared it with him. And that was part of our meditation practice and daily practice in the Vedanta tradition that I'm in. We meditate twice a day. And the meditation has several stages. And one of those stages is what in the Hindu tradition we call sankalpa. That is your resolution that you know, the purpose for which you are sitting down to meditate. And so I had been sort of phrasing that in my mind as resolving to attain realization, to have this experience. And I realized at a certain point, in fact, I had kind of a visionary experience once while meditating, and I was moved to change my sankalpa a little bit. And from something that I was phrasing in my mind as something that I was going to make happen by sitting here and meditating, and rephrasing it as being open to the divine grace at all times, in all places, and in all of its forms and manifestations. And there was a sense of relief or release when I made that change. It's like it wasn't all on me. It was surrendering to the divinity, letting the divinity flow, right? A lot of you who know me, you know, I'm a big Star Wars fan. It's like letting the force flow, right? And it took my meditation to a deeper level, and it was a very profound experience. And so the dynamic, I think, in my mind that I was had been worrying about, I would say, that this allowed me to kind of let go of, was this question of divine grace versus our own free will and our own action, which is a huge issue in many traditions, right? In the tradition I grew up in, right? I grew up in the Catholic tradition within Christianity. And of course, there's this big debate between Catholics and Protestants about, works versus grace, how much of it is grace, how much of it is works, and so on. And I had another very profound experience with another Swami, one from our Ramakrishna tradition, where a group of us were discussing this issue, and he cited a more senior Swami from the Ramakrishna order, Swami Yatishwaranda, who passed away a number of years ago. But he wrote something very profound about this question of is it divine grace or is it us, right? And is it grace or self-effort? And what he said was, divine grace manifests as self-effort, which to me just beautifully resolved this whole question, right? So it's like, and if you think in terms of non-duality, there's God, there's me, but in a sense, there is no final cut between those two, right? There is a flow of being, there's a sharing in being. And so am I opening myself up to that divine grace? Is that my action, or is that action itself an effect of grace? Or does that question ultimately dissolve itself when you have the experience? You open it, then you experience it directly. You know it through being rather than through the intellect, which can always trip you up because it needs to work with some finite frame of reference. So it's a very nicely dissolved this question for me. And so, and the broader question of free will, I mean, freedom is very strongly affirmed, I know, in the process tradition, Whitehead and so on. At the same time, we have the idea of, in the Hindu tradition, that none of us are really the doers of action at all, right? We think we are, but in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna explains, I'm the one doing it all, right? I'm doing it through you. And this is the paradox. There is great freedom in relinquishing that idea of my atomic individual making choices and doing things and letting that larger reality flow and act through me. And I think of the words of again, from the tradition in which I was born, Saint Francis of Assisi, Lord, make me an instrument of your peace, right? Let me be your instrument. Let that grace flow through me and manifest in the world. And so those are my maybe slightly less than academic, but more experiential comments on that cluster of topics.
Thank you. Thank you, Swami.
Thank you, Jeff, again. I'm just tempted to say something in relation to what you say because all of those are so interesting topics. Where to begin? Well, in our tradition will say that you began talking about the tendency sometimes to put God in a box or label him or limit the divine, and the need for probably to unknow God if you actually want to know God, to remain in that constant openness to allow for him to be all that he can be. In our tradition, there's a line that says that love moves like a snake, like moves in a zigzag way, which basically implies in an unpredictable dynamic. So you cannot anticipate how love will move. And of course, God is love, so he's unpredictable. He's unsettling by nature. And we should be okay with that. And of course, that has to do with surrendering, no? Like be okay with God being who he is and allowing that to happen. And in our tradition, we'll make this point that surrender for it to be voluntary and beautiful and deep has to be ideally prefaced by awe and wonder. Of surrender, we can be surrendering out of fear, out of social pressure, out of coercion. I surrender, like the opposite group in the battlefield is pointing at me, and I take the white flag. I surrender. And we associate the idea of surrender to that. But the Bhagavad Gita, for example, will say that when you realize the wonders of God, his position, his grace, his ever-evolving love, you will naturally feel drawn to give yourself to that. So you surrender out of wonder, so to say, which is a very, very interesting point to allow the letting go, to allow the giving up of certain assumptions and filters that we may have about how God is, how God has to be. And I say that particularly in my tradition, because in my tradition, we have lots of detailed information about God and about who God is, what does he do, what's his name, what's the name of his close companions, and very, very detailed information there, which can be a problem because we can think that we know everything about him, right? And he remains a mystery at the same time. One name of God in our tradition is Ghanashyam, which means dark cloud. It always reminds me that the cloud of unknowing in mystical Christianity. So Krishna is still always a mystery. So, like, for example, when you were given the example of the Murti or of the carved form of God that sometimes is worshipped on altars, in our particular tradition, that's very present. But ideally, the idea of worshipping a particular form of God is to become more and more aware that he's localized everywhere. And this particular, if I'm worshipping this form properly, the fruit of that is that when the altar is closed, I start to detect the presence of my deity everywhere else. My deity becomes universalized, so to say. Now, and that's why in our tradition we'll say the more immature practitioner sees God only in the altar, when the altar is open. The more advanced practitioner sees God in every heart. And the most advanced practitioner cannot not see God anywhere. He sees God everywhere. There's not a place he's not. But it may all begin by localizing him in one spot. At least let's begin in this altar, so to say. But eventually, we have to perceive the presence of the divine in everywhere. So that on one side, and a few thoughts brief, because so many topics, but in connection to work and grace and free will, we will say, as you quoted the Bhagavad Gita, sometimes we are not the kartahamiti manjate, we are not the doer. Bhagavad Gita, of course, is trying also to inspire us to be humble, because generally we think, I am the only doer. There's one verse in chapter 18 of the Gita where it just says, there are, like, if I'm not mistaken, seven factors of every action. So that's a very interesting point. It's God, it's the soul, it's nature, it's the gunas. There are different influences simultaneously playing out at every single action. So it's a very interesting way, again, to dethrone the false ego in terms of, I am the center of reality. And we will say that in terms of work and grace, as you nicely pointed, quoting this Swami, we will say, like, I will make an effort to get grace. But for us, to get grace is not so much like a transactional thing, like only if I make an effort, grace comes. But grace is always available. But unless and until I make my best effort, I won't be able to perceive that reality. So it's not that God is not gracious until and unless I do an effort. It's always there, but I need to access that reality by that. So I invest my free will in that direction. God has his own free will, considerably more free probably than ours in general. But for us, both wills operate together, are co-creative, co-participatory in its own way and from each side. So yeah, a few thoughts in complement to what you, Jeffrey, say. So thanks so much for that.
If I could just quickly add to what you just said, Swamiji, because it's a beautiful illustration of the point you were just making, how it's not our effort that makes God graceful. God's grace is always there, right? It's our effort that allows us to perceive it. Sri Ramakrishna said, the wind of the divine grace is always blowing. We have to raise our sail. Raise the sail on your little boat so that wind can carry you. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
I like that. I like that.
Yeah.
Well, we've got about 20 minutes left in the event, so why don't we open it up to questions? If you could raise your virtual hand so that way I can see you in the queue. we can take some questions. If we don't get any questions, you could talk a little bit about texts and traditions as ever fresh.
My favorite quote of the evening thus far is Swamiji's, we must unknow God to know God. I really like that.
Yes. Oh, I love that. It sounds a lot like Meister Eckhart.
Yes.
I must give proper reference to that. I forgot to quote the original author. Sorry for that. That's my friend of mine, Richard Rohr, Father Richard Rohr.
Oh, well, so, there you go.
So yeah, he's one of also my main inspirations. And in this case, he's the one who mentioned that. I quote that line in my book, Radical Personalism, and I put the proper footnote in place there.
Yeah. Wonderful. When you were talking about seeing God everywhere, it reminded me of him also saying that he feels like the point of the Christian Eucharist or communion He said if we can see God in those common elements of life, we can see God everywhere.
In our particular tradition, and we have this ceremony offering incense and lamb called Artik, and all these elements represent earth, water, fire, ether, which basically means all that the world is made of. So ideally, the idea is all the world is represented there, and we offer that to God. So if you have the eyes to see, the whole world is like a big Arctic plate to be that is connected to God, and His grace is omnipresent. And as I like to see, if we do not perceive the omnipresent grace of God, that means we are omniabsent, basically.
Right. I like that. All right, Mike, I see your hand. Why don't you unmute and ask your question?
All right. Sorry, both gentlemen. The way that I came to any kind of process thought was a video of John Cobb inviting me to study cosmology, that there's plenty of easier things to study, but that he felt that was the appropriate and proper place to really rise up to meet the challenge. Could you say a few things about cosmology in your two traditions? Thanks in advance.
Thank you.
Somebody, would you like to start?
Please, Jeffrey, please.
Oh, okay. So the cosmology in Hinduism, more broadly speaking, and I can even say a little bit my tradition specifically, is it's not simply identical to, but it fits very well with a lot of scientific cosmology, right? Because you have the idea, of course, we've talked already kind of talked around at least a bit the idea of an evolving universe, and that this universe itself is a manifestation of divinity. And I know as I was sort of having the dialogue in my own mind earlier in my journey between Christianity and Hindu traditions, you know, that there's the idea of the singular divine incarnation in Christianity. And of course, in Hinduism, we have many divine incarnations, many, you know, avatars, manifestations. But in a sense, the universe itself is a divine manifestation. And there's a Vaishnava tradition it's related to the Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition. It's the Sri Vaishnava tradition of Ramanujacharya. And he talks about the cosmos, refers to it as the body of God, as the body of Ishvara, the body of the divine, and that the relationship between God and cosmos can be analogized with the relationship of the soul and the body, right? That the just as the jiva is present all throughout the living being and yet not reducible to it, in the same way God is present in every atom, every molecule, every subatomic particle of the cosmos, and yet not reducible to any of those, right? God is not simply the sum total of physical reality, but something vastly greater, but manifesting in and as and through that physical cosmos, so that we can see the entire history of the cosmos as the unfolding and manifesting of divine potentials, the kinds of potentials we were talking about earlier. And it's also, of course, the field in which our evolution occurs, right? As we are in this with countless other jivas, countless other beings through time. The time scales of the Hindu tradition, again, are very similar to things we find, not identical, but analogous to things we find in modern science. For example, the idea that the cosmos is billions of years old. That's not news to Hindus, right? That's something that's been taught for many, many centuries, many millennia, in texts, in the Vedic texts, in the Bhagavata Purana, for example, and many other texts. You have elaboration of vast scales of cosmic time, and even of different universes, different realms, right? You see this word loka used, which is often translated as world, or you could call it a realm. Sometimes it's translated as planet. It could be a planet like we think of planets in the modern sense, but it could also refer to what we might call a parallel universe, or just another reality that is coexisting with our own and in some way connected with our own. And so we have a vast universe in which everything is unfolding over the course of eons, and it really has no definite beginning or end. Sometimes students will ask me, well, what's the story of creation according to the Hindus? And I'll say, well, there are many stories of creation. In the Rig Veda alone, there are multiple stories of creation. Creation, if we look at all these stories as a kind of sum total, it's a process. It's something that is ongoing with no absolute beginning, no absolute end. But it is purposeful. It is purposeful, and this differentiates this tradition from maybe more materialistic perspective, where everything's the result of kind of random collisions of particles and so on. Now, there is an ongoing conscious manifestation occurring in and through all of us, all the beings that make up the cosmos.
I will totally, of course, agree with what Jeff mentioned. In our tradition, again, we do not entertain the notion of, for example, creator ex nihilo, but like on ongoing cycle. We may talk in terms of cycles of creation, maintenance, and destruction, but there's no beginning to those cycles, basically. In Sanskrit, there's this term anadi, which basically means without beginning. So it's an ongoing process, but also we will, that is something without beginning and without an end doesn't mean that there's nothing in a constant unfolding at the same time. We will see that more in kind of, because even though the time cycle seems to start and wane and what wakes and wane and end at one point and start again, it may sound a little bit like circular instead of evolutionary, but actually our conception is more in terms of spiral, not circularity, but expansion at the same time. Because again, in our tradition, love and God's heart is over evolving. And as I like to put in my recent book, as God's heart evolves, matter evolves to accommodate that. Matter evolves in tandem to accommodate God's heart. Because our tradition, as most Hindu traditions will say, yeah, the backdrop of cosmic manifestation is the explosion of divine love. And sorry if it sounds too poetic, but that's how it's described. Now, the Vedanta Sutra says, Lokavattu Lila Kaivalyam. The whole material creation sometimes called Shristi Lila, or the divine play of creation. And the commentators explain that the heart of God and the loving interaction between God and his lovers, so to say, reaches a point of outpouring, overflowing, not in a point of time, it's a way of speaking. And that outflowing, that outpouring becomes the cosmos, so to say. So generally it's very clearly this connection between what we see here and how the evolution we may perceive here on this plane is connected to that. And I appreciate what Jeffrey mentioned also in connection to descriptions, like in the Bhagavad Purana, the numbers that they give, a friend, brother of mine in our tradition, he has written recently a whole book, he's a scientist, and making the correlation between the numbers that modern science entertains at currently, like with the Big Bang and so on. And this astonishing correlation between the numbers given in the Bhagavad Purana thousands of years ago. And with other things, with the end of certain ages, for example, like the Permian mass extinction, I won't enter into the details, but the age of the solar system, they're all aligning almost absolutely perfectly with the Bhagavad Purana. So it's a very interesting point. Like some friends of mine say, what mystics see, scientists find about a few thousand years after, so to say, right? So yeah, a few words in complement to what Jeffrey mentioned in terms of cosmology.
Thank you. Yes, I've often said that these days, the scientists who are studying the biggest cosmos level things and the smallest level things sound more and more like mystics all the time.
Yeah. Just a little more on the same topic. One thing, Swamiji, just to pick up on what he was just saying, if one is, of course, skeptical, one could say, well, you know, they got lucky, right? But that's pretty lucky, because the detail is incredible in terms of correlation.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I find that you see this in Hindu traditions, you see it to some extent in the Buddhist and Jain traditions as well. These traditions were all in dialogue with one another.
Mm-hmm.
And what is widely believed among practitioners is that if one refines the mind a great deal through spiritual practice, through meditation, through surrender to God, one can perceive certain things directly. One intuits certain things. Yeah. And then that is expressed in texts, in language that is comprehensible to the people of that particular time and culture. And as Swamiji was just saying, as we go through the very slow and careful deductive and inductive scientific method, a lot of these things are being verified. And so you don't find a clash between science and religion so much with Hindu traditions. There are certainly things there that go beyond what, you know, can be currently verified through science, but I personally don't find anything that contradicts it. There's nothing there that makes me doubt it or say, well, that part should be, you know, rejected as archaic or something. In fact, it makes me think that some of the things that are there that are not part of current science maybe will someday. Just because the track record is quite good of the tradition. And it's interesting to note that when a lot of these texts were first translated into English in the 19th century by European scholars, a lot of what we call the modern scientific worldview didn't exist yet. Mm-hmm. And they were sometimes very dismissive of the Hindu texts. Oh, look at these fantastical, you know, huge numbers. These fanciful Hindus talk about a world being billions of years old. Ha ha ha. And now 100 years later, you know, 150 years later, we're saying, no, it's like that.
We say ha 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 now.
We say ha ha now. Of course, people will be saying ha ha at us just sometime in the future about some other topic. But no, I this is one of the things I find very compelling about this particular tradition.
Yeah, wonderful. Janet Weathers put a question in the chat. She says, David Griffin spoke of a different understanding of the power of God in reflecting on the nature of evil as not being an expression of God's intention. How do your traditions deal with the issue of evil?
Hmm. Yeah. Swami, do you want to take
okay.
that one?
Okay, I'll take the lead once. In my particular tradition, we will not speak about evil as some sort of intrinsic, of course, quality of certain particular beings. We'll mostly speak in terms of avidya, the terms in Sanskrit that sometimes is translated as ignorance or lack of vidya, which means knowledge or education. So we will speak about evil more as a symptom of avidya. For us, avidya is kind of the root cause problem, which means basically an awareness of what is what, an awareness of reality, an awareness of who I am, an awareness of the divine, an awareness, a lack of awareness of what is what, which takes me to act in very dysfunctional, disaligned ways with reality, which ends up being evil in many cases. But we will never talk, we don't entertain, for example, a notion like the devil as a separate entity, which is there like competing with God or something like that. We will say God is God. There's nobody that can compete with him, although we try our best many times. And in that case, we can speak of the evil, the devil, so to say, but it's mostly in terms of our lack of awareness of the divine. So we'll mostly focus our attention on this idea of avidya, lack of proper knowledge and education and awareness about the divine and who we are in connection to the divine, and that takes us to behave in evil ways in some cases. So the way to counteract that is by receiving proper guidance, aligning with reality, and basically evil is no longer there, so to say. So we will try to emphasize these ideas, like whatever you may call capital sins or evil or this or that, all that we generally reduce them to symptoms of avidya. And sometimes I like to say that in lectures, and for some people it's a little shocking when I say wars are not a problem, raping is not a problem. All those are symptoms of the actual problem, which is this avidya. Now, when we solve the actual problem, the symptoms disappear automatically, basically. But sometimes the problem is that we misidentify the symptom for the problem. So we try to solve the problem. We're just creating some relief in the symptom of the problem while the problem remains at its root. So that's what we will say. Jeffrey?
So, I'm completely in agreement with everything Swamiji has just said, that what we think of as evil arises from a profound disconnection between our conscious self, our ego, the personality that's making decisions in the waking state, and our, you could say, our true self, our authentic self, that higher potential. And God, one manifestation of God is that potential within us that's always drawing us toward itself. And of course, we have the power to refuse that, but then that only gives rise to suffering, and that gives rise to harmful behaviors, harmful actions. One thing, and sometimes in moral discourse, we get a little tripped up, I think, because sometimes we use the term evil a little too broadly. Like, I like the way Swamiji's using it to really refer to moral evil, right? Things that people do that they should not do, right? That cause harm. Sometimes you'll hear things like earthquakes and tornadoes and hurricanes and so on described as natural evil. The term for this more in the Hindu tradition would simply be suffering, right? Which is not, we could say, so much created by God in order to sort of test us. It's not like that, but we have the power to use occasions of suffering as opportunities for learning and for deeper growth. And so Swami Vivekananda talks about this in his book on Karma Yoga. Karma Yoga is basically doing good, but without any expectation of reward for oneself. It's basically doing good for the world, worshiping God in the form of suffering beings, helping suffering beings. And he says that, we can see the suffering that we experience in this material world as a kind of challenge, almost akin to workout equipment in the gym, right? Where he says this world, he calls it a grand moral gymnasium, where we're taking our exercise so that we can strengthen spiritually. So I apply this often to experiences I've had in my own life with suffering that was not really inflicted by anyone evil. It were just circumstances that arose that were very painful. The circumstances that led to the death of my father, that would be the most profound one, I think. And then on a more trivial level, but it was still pretty big for me, was when I broke my ankle a few years ago. And I'm really grateful that I had that experience. And that might sound odd, but if I had had that experience much earlier in my life, I would have had a major crisis, right? I would have, I was in San Diego. I was not at home. I was there for a conference. I missed the conference. I had to have surgery. I mean, there were so many things that I could have worried about, right, during that. But because I'd been practicing what we call our sadhana, our spiritual practice for many years, it was fairly easy for me to sort of see my broken ankle as something distinct from me. And then to distance myself from that pain. I still felt the pain, but I didn't let it disturb my awareness. And in fact, my doctor in the emergency room was working on my foot. He actually made a point to ask me about it. He said, I've never seen anyone, he said, in all my years of medical practice, seen anyone so obviously in pain who was so cheerful. Because I was joking with the nursing staff and with the doctor and so on. And I don't want to gross anyone out, but my foot was turned at a 90 degree angle from how it's supposed to be, right? I was in pain, but the doctor said that. And I don't know where it came from. It just spontaneously kind of came out of my mouth. I said, pain is in the body, suffering is in the mind. And he said, oh, that's interesting. And then we got into a conversation about, philosophy. And so, again, it's not so much that God puts these things in our path in order to, toy with us, but they're opportunities for us to, if we use them wisely, to expand our awareness and deepen in our practice.
Can I share one word in that connection, sure, very briefly?
Yes, please.
Okay. No, just I was thinking about your words, Jeffrey, and I really appreciate them in connection to our moral evil. The idea that, okay, we have a very brighter, ever-evolving potential, but sometimes we have also an ever-devolving potential. And that indirectly is speaking about how high we can reach, by seeing how low we can get. That indirectly speaking, if we will redirect that in the proper direction, it will be tremendously glorious, so to say. And in connection with the unavoidable pain or whatever, some material circumstances, tsunamis or whatever you were describing, Jeff, also for us, it will be a point of generally the loss of and renewal cycles that exist in the whole of reality and making the point of death in order to attain a new form of birth, so to say, whether externally, but also internally on a daily basis, part of this ever unfolding process, and how, whether it's a natural disaster or it's our own moral evil, God is always trying to create the best possible scenario according to whatever situations we are in. I like to give the example, talking recently with a rabbi, he mentioned the example of the GPS, that you drive in the wrong direction, you make your worst possible choice, and the GPS recalibrates over and over again, recalibrates. You make the worst possible choice and God presents the best possible scenario to accommodate your worst possible choice.
Yes.
And regarding the suffering, just the last point, I like to always recall how the very first chapter of the Bhagavad Gita is called Vishada Yoga, which basically means the yoga of despair. So right from the beginning of one of our main texts, it's talking about despair and pain, not as something to avoid, to escape, to solve, but many times to hold until the pain solves ourselves. Now, it's not so much about us solving the pain, but allowing the suffering to solve us. So it's part of our tradition as well. Yeah.
Yeah. That's beautiful. Well, we are out of time.
Oh, okay.
Well, Jeff, if you want to do a closing comment?
If that's okay, yeah. Well, I just want to say I really like Bhakti Rasa's posting here in relation to this conversation. Bhakti Rasa posted, suffering is an arena where we can flesh out our faith. I think that's beautifully said. And someone posted about asking about non-theistic traditions. There are non-theistic traditions in Hinduism. There's the Jain tradition, the Buddhist tradition. And I would just say, from my perspective, coming from the Ramakrishna tradition, so the question was, how do the non-theistic traditions sort of fit with what we've been talking about in very theistic terms? From the perspective of the Ramakrishna tradition, all of this that we've been describing can also be described, can also be conceptualized in non-personal terms, non-theistic terms. And that creates a very different kind of conversation in many respects. But you can see that the contours of the same reality are being described. And Ramakrishna would say that, you know, this is just another way of conceptualizing. And, you know, one thing that's kind of been at the back of my mind throughout our discussion is that, you know, I think you could tell from our conversation, you know, that I think for a lot of us here, you know, we're very much in love with God, right? The idea of God is something liberating for us. It is something that is really essential to our existence. A lot of people hear the word God and feel a lot of pain, and they think about very dysfunctional systems that have been imposed upon them that they need to unknow. And part of that unknowing might even be rejecting at least the concept of God for at least some time, and maybe throughout their lives. And traditions like Buddhism, I think, give another way of conceptualizing that that then opens up spiritual life for people for whom this concept of God becomes a stumbling block and becomes a difficulty because of the associations that have come out of it. I think that's totally, I mean, from the perspective of my tradition, that's completely valid. And Swami Vivekananda even said, you know, you don't have to be religious in the conventional sense, right? If you commit yourself to the good of all beings, that commitment, he says, can take you to realization.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Well, I think we can all agree with Linda's post in the chat that this has been a very substantive and enriching discussion. So let's give our speakers a hand, a virtual hand.
Thank you for the opportunity to be here. And Swami, thank you so much for being in this conversation.
Thank you, yes. Jeff, for being here. It has been my great pleasure. And Sherry and everyone in the community for the invitation as well. Yeah.
Yes, thank you. We're very indebted to both of you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.